Right. Hey everyone, so nice to see you all. We're starting module 8 today of 10, so kind of fun, right, that we're in the sort of home stretch, although for some of you you'll be like, what the heck happened, this can't be true. I know this always happens for me as well, but we've got lots of time. We've got a couple of months left in the program, and also know that, you know, for 6 months afterwards we have monthly calls. Like, you know, there's no rush. You just take your time and we'll figure it all out. So in this last kind of third of the program, what we are sort of turning our attention to is how to kind of move into coaching our clients, resourcing our clients to have these healthy self resources. So self-belief, self-worth, self-trust, self-acceptance, these four kind of aspects of the healthy adult self, that when they are kind of raised, when the client feels really resourced in those aspects of their healthy adult self, self-doubt just has less to do. Right, the client is able to kind of interrupt those self-doubt patterns. And so over the next three modules, what we'll be doing is looking at different aspects of the healthy adult self and how to bring those to life. So today we're going to be talking about conflict for the next couple of weeks. Then we take a break and we go into like some specific tools for these four resources, and then in our last module we talk about behavioral change and goals, kind of human motivation stuff. And these are the aspects that I've found over the years our clients mostly struggle with, right? If you think about the psychological risks that we that our self-doubt is trying to protect us from, most of them sort of fit in the realm of conflict, right? So judgment, criticism, confrontation or conflict, rejection. These are the risks that, you know, even kind of loss, abandonment, if we expand out into all possible risks, we find that at the root of those is this kind of fear of conflict. What will other people think? So a lot of our self-doubt is activated by our relationships with other people. What I found over the years is that A, most people with self-doubt have a crunchy relationship with conflict. Most humans have not had healthy conflict modeled well, particularly those of us who are kind of 30 plus. I think some of us in the younger generations are kind of getting there, but no, not for a lot of us. And thirdly, and probably most disappointing, is when I kind of made the real link between the sort of fear of conflict, this worry about conflict and all aspects of it, and I threw myself into, okay, so what's the evidence? Where's the research? What works? There isn't really a ton of good stuff that is particularly geared towards folks with self-doubt. So what you're going to find as you look through these tools, particularly in the conflict module, are approaches that I've used and practiced with clients over the years. And what I'd love you to do is kind of experiment and play with those, and also make them your own. Like take these as start points for what your clients need from you, right? These, what you'll find is that there are some really good like resources that you might think, like, for example, the criticism map. When I've used that with clients, they just freaking love it, and it really starts to diffuse that kind of worry about criticism. They start to see how they can use that. For others, things like compassionate confrontation and the language we use, that is a kind of, I've taken that from other researchers and practices. Particularly nonviolent communication and things like that. That's been definitely been informed by that. But the actual courage to say these things is often the thing that stops the client from actually taking action. So one of the reasons why we wait till module 8 to look at this stuff is because we need to sort of understand that context, that even when our clients can see, oh, I really need to have this difficult conversation, or I just really need to put some clear kind of policies in place so I'm running my business, you know, with some boundaries, the risk of conflict is the thing that stops them from doing those things. So the way that we're going to approach this module is we're going to spend today kind of discussing how we as practitioners and humans feel about conflict, our relationship with it. And next week we'll look more at our clients and how we actually coach with them around these tools. Yeah. So let's, I'll just share my screen so you can kind of see where we're going with this. We'll do the usual and just look at the aims of this module. We're going to talk about your relationship, our relationship with conflict, maybe do some coaching, but certainly some discussion, and then look at what you might take away to your practice pods for your own self-reflection work. As you're practicing with other classmates, now that you have access to everybody's contacts, you can start to play with all of this. Yeah. So the aims of this module, we want to explore our relationship with conflict, right? And the reason for that is however you feel about conflict, and we are going to kind of come on to talk about that, what your relationship is with it, what it brings up in you, that is going to leak into your client conversations about conflict. Right? This is the area that is rife for entanglement with our client stuff. Yeah. So in order to support our clients to explore their relationship with conflict, we want to get pretty, you know, kind of understanding, at least have a little poke around in our own relationship. We're going to consider the styles of conflict, and we'll talk a bit about that today. The experience of emotions, which are often, you know, part of that fear and worry around conflict, is I'm going to get angry, or I'm going to experience someone else's anger. All of that gets tied in. And all of this is, the aim of this is to resource the client with some tools, with some resources, some ways of being that can support themselves in the face of these risks, judgment, criticism, and confrontation. Okay. We want to get practiced in ourselves and with our clients at the art of accepting that conflict is part of human relationships. Conflict just is. And there are some really great tools that we can support them with around reframing, working with polarities, working with criticism, using accountable language, all of that kind of stuff. Just really good, solid sort of foundational tools that can support a client so that when they are inevitably faced with some conflict that activates their self-doubt, they feel like they've got some resources, they've got some ways to kind of support themselves. So there are kind of aims, and the reason for this is, certainly for today, is that I believe that for us to show up as self-belief coaches in our healthy selves, we need to have some peace around our own relationship with conflict. If we don't, you can just imagine a client comes along and says, how do I kind of sort out this conflict with my partner, my boss, my sister-in-law, my netball coach, whatever, right? How do I figure that out? And if we have a very avoidant or accommodating style, we won't be able to help our clients because we will be protecting them from the things we worry about. Yeah, make sense? So our kind of stance on this is conflict is inevitable. We want to be able to meet our clients where they are. If they have self-doubt, the fear of conflict is likely to be quite high. Any instances of conflict is likely to be quite activating for them. And we want to be able to support them, you know, to do what they need to do. So the other thing that I think we miss when we get into that place of feeling like conflict is wrong, or every every experience of conflict has to be kind of a difficult, awful thing, is that we really, really miss out on the benefits of conflict. You know, things like an issue gets addressed, you know, we can figure out, oh, a boundary's been crossed and I need to advocate for something here. Something I value is being diminished and I need to voice that, you know, for my own integrity. Maybe you're outgrowing a relationship or a context of, in your life of some sort. So if we are constantly expelling a ton of energy, just not thinking about those things, just trying to avoid it and keep the peace, we miss out on those benefits of actually being able to be quite active in advocating for our own stuff, for our own needs. So having said all that, right, it's nice in theory, isn't it? That conflict is something that's inevitable and healthy and it's a good thing to talk about. I don't know about you, but it still makes me kind of come out in the cold sweats sometimes. Right? I still don't love it, still don't feel like conflict's my favourite. I'm pretty good at bouncing back now, like if there's, you know, if I get criticized or judged, or I feel that I am being criticized or judged, if there is some sort of confrontation, you know, I sort of feel like I can kind of manage that, but it's not my favorite. Still not my favorite. And I think a lot of that makes sense when I think about my relationship with conflict and what I grew up learning about conflict, which was in a home that was pretty chaotic and everybody had lots of emotions, and you know, we didn't keep those to ourselves in our family. It was a kind of rule that if you had a feeling, it was best to get it out. I was saying to the class this morning that I learned from my father that he felt that an argument, debate, was very much encouraged, and he felt that it was a reflection of his passionate Italian heritage. Now, I don't know how true these things are, but I did do one of those 23andMe things. We have absolutely no Italian heritage in our family. Absolutely none. So that was just an excuse. But I guess, you know, I share that because I think the way we learn, you know, what we learn about conflict, our kind of formative relationship with the role we take when conflict comes up, the feelings that it kind of engenders in us, it fosters in us. We learn these things in our families mostly, you know. So I wanted just sort of throw that out there and you know, let's have a bit of a chat. You know, just think about what did you learn about conflict growing up? What still sort of sits with you today? What is it about conflict that you feel either positive, negative, or somewhere in the middle around? Let's normalize this very mixed bag of experience. Anyone wanna share? Yeah, Scott.
It's interesting actually, because for me, my upbringing was at times it could be quite a tempestuous household, and my wife's upbringing was a lot different to mine, from the perspective that you know, they hold things back, things are swept under the carpet, whereas for me, I think for me, I get activated relatively quicker than her. And it means that I think for me, because I'm always on the defense, or I do think I'm on the defense a lot, I will jump to conclusions. And it wouldn't be the first time that, you know, I'll jump to a conclusion, as in I've bought into the illusion. And sometimes as I've gotten older, I've learned more to, if I have a feeling, not to. I didn't really know a lot about the healthy self until I came on the course. But what I would say is, when I when I have that feeling, as I've grown older, I've learned to wait for that feeling to subside before I approach someone. But I wouldn't say I'm comfortable in conflict, but because I've grown up with it, it seems the norm, if that makes sense, Sass.
And I think it's something to just kind of sit with as well, Scott, as we talk about the conflict styles, the difference between, you know, when you meet someone, you know, and you've married your wife, and how you have different conflict styles and what that actually does to the nature of your conflict, because you're just approaching it from a different angle. It's a good thing to just hang on to. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool. Thanks for sharing.
No worries.
Love that as well. Angela just sharing in the chat, the one who could yell the loudest wins. Oof, yeah, I really resonate with that. Or if you avoid it, it will be because you're seen as difficult or too emotional. A whole lot of gaslighting to convince you that your feelings and concerns aren't valid. Yeah. Really resonate with that. And it's interesting, isn't it, to reflect what of those things may still either be with you in the here and now, Angela, or maybe just get activated at some times, you know, in some contexts. It's so interesting, isn't it, how even as a healthy adult, lots of resources, you're going to be able to see how that isn't your reality now, but there may still be instances or even people that kind of echo that experience. Yeah. Beautiful. Thanks for sharing. Anyone relate? Anyone have a different? Yeah, Jane. Oh, you're just muted, love.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting module for me, because I think I have always thought of myself as quite assertive.
Right.
And I've never really thought I had an issue with conflict. However, I've also been aware that I'm not very good at looking after my own needs or keeping promises to myself. And I've always kind of wondered, oh, you're so assertive. You're very good at getting things done. Why can't you look after yourself? It's, you know, it's been a thing that I've been really working on for a while. So it's really interesting doing some reflection on this module and realizing that I'm accommodating. And that's why I don't notice conflict, because I accommodate it so much of the time. Particularly in family situations, the kind of keep peace, look after everybody. My job in the middle is to make sure it's all smooth and okay. And even in work with clients, the kind of tendency to say yes, over deliver, not rock the boat. I could suddenly see it really clearly.
That's fascinating. Mm. Well, and you know, I'm both, you know, like heartened that this is, you know, helps you to kind of see, oh, that can kind of explain that pattern. But also it's kind of shit as well, isn't it? When you realize, oh, the reason I'm not really worried about it is because I'm just letting everything be accommodated for except me.
But as soon as I saw that, I mean, almost literally as soon as I saw it, as one of the conflict styles, I just went, oh, you don't have to do that. So I have actually started noticing when I'm doing it more. Well, I didn't even notice before. Now I've started noticing and just pausing and thinking, okay, I have a choice. What do I want to do here?
Brilliant.
So it's been great. But I grew up, I'm more like your wife, Scott. My family, extreme avoidant. Do not express anything. Do not get angry. And literally, I've been shut down before. And I find that really, really painful to be shut down. And maybe that's why I accommodate rather than risk being shut down.
Yeah. Can I add something to that, Jane? Because we're in the same practice pod. It's really interesting you're saying that, because I would have taken you for being a really assertive, confident person. And it's just interesting how you've articulated that. But on the flip side of the coin as well, I can kind of sense where you're actually coming from. So, you know, it's just really interesting you've shared that.
And it's different in different contexts. But yeah. Tess, go ahead. Yeah. I'm going to silence myself.
Please. It's the last thing we want. I was just going to say both things can be true, right? Like in different contexts. I think I heard you say context. So, you know, both things can be true, that we can actually feel quite self-assured and pretty, you know, able to articulate and advocate for ourselves and our needs in one context, and in another we're like, "Ooh, what happened here?" So it's just good to notice, you know, that's the thing. And I think what you've shared, Jane, is the thing, is once you see the pattern, then you can go, oh, I'm in choice. I get to decide what I want to do. Yeah.
I guess that's where the complexity and ambiguity comes into things.
Totally. Totally, Scott. Yeah. Yeah. Jane, Colette, do you want to share anything that's coming up for you? Yeah, Colette.
Yeah, I will. So it's quite interesting to think about context, really, because when I was growing up, my dad was an alcoholic and he was quite violent in the house. So everyone just kind of retreated. So it's like, be quiet, stay safe, all of that, you know. So I spent quite a long time working on that and realized that actually I don't have to do that anymore. So I can now, with most people, I'm able to have a conversation without it, you know, scaring me or getting into shouting or anything. But when I go back to family gatherings, it all comes out again. It's like, oh, this feels really crunchy. I can't do it in that situation. I can only do it in my situation now. So it's really interesting to think about that context and how it's kind of stays with us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I always found, particularly when I was working a lot one-to-one, and you may find this as well, if, for those of you who do this, most of your work one-to-one, I would find in the January period, most of that kind of couple of months was processing Christmas with family. And it's very much that thing, suddenly, yeah, Jane's thumbs up, and suddenly you find yourself kind of in your childhood bedroom going, what the hell am I? Who am I in this place? I turn into, you know, a teenager or whatever. And it's, yeah, exactly what you're describing, Colette. Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. Jane, is there anything you want to share?
I've just been having all these memories pop up. I had a step family that in my early teens, and then I lived with my dad and stepmom, and just the difference, like I had to be logical, had to have reasoning. If I was going to have an emotion with my stepdad, with my dad and stepmom, I wasn't really allowed to have feelings. Like when I broke up with my boyfriend after living together for 4 years, I asked if I could come just spend the weekend just to distract myself. And they were like, yeah, but don't be crying around the house. It was like, oh, okay. Yeah. But over the last 20 years with my husband, he doesn't let me like shut down and run away. He'll be like, no, what is this? So it's kind of changed. But yeah, like everyone's saying, it's like you go back into that and you kind of go back to what the expectation was in that relationship.
Yeah, completely, completely. It is fascinating, isn't it? Because I think our early relationships can also really impact our response to conflict. Things like you said, you know, blended families in your teens, early relationships, bullying experiences in high school, or just being kind of in friendship groups where there was different conflict styles, perhaps. I know a lot of women have had quite wounding experiences in groups of other women because it's like the friendship group can't hold conflict. So it sort of disintegrates and falls apart, and someone has to be the bad guy often. And, you know, I was also thinking this week, I was watching a BBC show. For those of you in the UK, there's a show called This is Based on a Pack of Lies. And it's very funny, dark show, but it has at the center of it a coercively controlled relationship. And I had this very visceral response to some of the things that the male character was saying. I was like, oh my God, it's my first husband. And I remember, you know, I had to sort of pause it and say to my current husband, can we just talk about what happened here? Because I think that was my experience, not obviously to the extent of the show, but it was a really interesting kind of, my body told me something about this isn't right. And this is often what will happen in conflict or in the anticipation of conflict. Our bodies will tell us first that something is off, something isn't quite right. So yeah, it's really, really interesting. Yeah, I'm just kind of checking up on the chat. So we've got Adrian and Angela contributing that way. So yeah, Adrian's saying, I learned that people who approach conflict head on are more trustworthy because they let you know where they stand. And I'm quite wary of avoidant or passive aggressive types even now. And yeah, Angela's saying, done a lot of work around the things that she mentioned. And the moment someone starts yelling, I'm out of there. Yeah. And Jane, yeah, had the exact experience after a breakup of a long-term relationship. Yeah. So other people kind of teach us about conflict. And much like any of our protective beliefs and behaviours, we kind of form these patterns over time. And we're like, oh, that's the way I keep myself safe in that kind of context, in that kind of situation. When it comes to conflict, I really like Thomas Kalman's conflict style kind of approach. The styles that I've adapted to kind of look at this through the lens of self-doubt are based on his model. And I found that really helpful because it starts to explain that in much the same way that we might, you know, have a style of response around visibility or any kind of vulnerability of any sort, the same happens with conflict. And so what can happen and what I see time and again with my clients and clients over the years, and I'm sure that this may resonate, is that what happens is that pattern becomes our sole response to conflict. So we just go, okay, the way to deal with conflict is to accommodate or to avoid or to, you know, meet it head on. And that becomes our kind of default setting. So our body tells us something here is off, there's some conflict. This is what I need to do to stay safe. And my approach to this is I think what we actually need to do is have a bit of a toolkit that gives us choices. And all of the conflict styles, the four main conflict styles, have real intelligence and advantages. Like they're not, it's not like this, it's wrong to avoid conflict. Sometimes that's absolutely the right thing to do. But what I've found is super helpful for clients is we just want to expand your repertoire so that when you are in a situation where conflict is around, you feel like you're choosing based on the level of courage you feel in the moment, based on, you know, the context of the relationship, what feels right for you, so that you sort of shake up this default setting when it comes to conflict. Yeah. Can we just do a little check-in? Who among you have had a look and familiarized yourself with the four conflict styles? Is anyone? Yep, I'm sure Jane has. Cool. Okay. Jane Willis, I was saying, will definitely have, because I know she's on it, but that's okay. All right, and great, Adrian, you have as well, and Jane has as well. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about these. I'm just going to show you a graphic. The reason is we can start to sort of see, oh, this is where I have some choices, right? So these are the four main conflict styles: accommodating, adversarial, passive-aggressive, and avoidant, right? And what I would say is that the majority of clients with self-doubt are in the accommodating avoidant sort of place until pushed And then they go rabid and into adversarial, usually, right? And passive aggressive is a kind of mix of, excuse me, it's a combination of avoidant and adversarial, right? So we'll talk a little bit about that. But I just want us to kind of have a little chat about these different styles and what the intelligences and advantages are. Because the style we, I think, is the best way to sort of to equip ourselves and our clients is to actually have the combination of all of these. And I call that the accepting style. When we accept that conflict is inevitable, it's a part of human relationships, and there's huge benefits to being in healthy conflict. And what we want to do, though, is vary up the way that we respond so that we feel like it's a place of advocacy for ourselves. Yeah. And for the relationship often as well. So if we start with the accommodating style, really, really common among folks with self-doubt. And you can imagine, right? An accommodating person generally tends to kind of vote for the relationship rather than their own needs, if you like. I'll let you read all the details, but generally, if you're an accommodating person, you're pretty cooperative and attentive in the relationship, and you're wanting the relationship to be preserved at all costs. That usually feels like the most important thing, and often more important than your own needs. Yeah. So there's real intelligence and advantages to that, like in any kind of team dynamic or a family or any kind of group setting, having someone who's pretty flexible and accommodating is fantastic. It kind of is the grease that oils the wheels, you know. Usually folks with an accommodating style are pretty attentive. They're usually quite generous. There's a sense of caring for other people, and generally wanting to be quite flexible and adaptive. Great. And this can tip over, right, into not quite knowing your own preferences, right? Believing that you're valued because you accommodate everybody else, right? And maybe that can lead to burnout. Like lots of people with a sort of burnout tendency will usually have some kind of accommodation or style, and that can match up with that martyred protector. It's usually a kind of connection there. Who among you feel like, oh yes, that's my default. That's my default setting, is accommodating. So I just want you to think about this. What do you think the impact of having that as a default style is on your coaching work? What comes up?
You can let a client off the hook, can't you?
In what way, Scott?
Well, I can clearly get this because we talk about ambiguity and complexity. Although I'm not a stranger to conflict in my own family dynamic around certain family members, I was very, very accommodating. And I think I've been in situations in the past with clients where, based on their strength of character, I may have sensed or I may have unearthed, for example, a weakness in their financial situation. But because of the nature of them as a person, I've not followed through. And I felt I've been a bit activated, nervous. Mm-hmm. And so I think that can mean that I've avoided challenges, which in essence may not always be within the best interests of the client.
Yeah. It's so interesting, isn't it, right? Our style is going to leak into our client work. And this is a really classic example. I'm sure all of us have been in situations where I've even found just the clients you really admire, sometimes there might be, this can tip into a bit of a power dynamic where you sort of feel like, oh, I don't want to say anything that might, you know, piss them off or upset them in any way, right?
I had that this morning.
Yeah. And so just think about, like, where are you holding back in your client work in service of accommodating? And what are your choices? Right. What might be something you can do around that? Because this is worthy of your attention to even experiment with, you know. Might just be small things, you know. Maybe you kind of name what's happening between you. Maybe you say something different, shake it up a little bit. Maybe you look at what's another way I can approach this. Yeah. Anyone else want to share anything about that accommodating style in your client work?
Feels like you're going to be just running on empty the whole time if you're trying to, like, check every box and keep everyone happy and do everything, you know, that you possibly can to avoid things and be really accommodating. It's just like, God, it feels like, where's the, where do you take the breath then?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and you know what you're describing, Colette. I think often if our accommodating style shows up in our business, it can be things like constantly letting people reschedule, not having any boundaries around your time, you know, or allowing people to have endless payment flexibility. Like, you pay me when you're ready, you know, and I'll just keep on serving. Right. So it's just interesting to reflect where might I need to, you know, have a different choice? What might my business be requiring of me? So that I can preserve my greatest asset, which is my own energy. Yeah.
Excuse me, Sass, can I ask a question on that, please, if possible? I actually think a strength of mine in the past has been the fact that, you know, I will do that extra mile for a client. But I have had instances as well where I feel that being too nice has cost me a client. And I kind of like get a little stuck sometimes. And it's kind of like I've got the devil on the one shoulder and the angel on the other saying, you've got to be really, really nice. And that, you know, people really value service. And then sometimes I do think, well, you know, people can take the piss. You know, if you give too much.
A question I think might be worth sitting with is, what is in the best service of the client?
Okay.
Right. So rather than I've got to be nice all the time. Nice to me is like one of the worst words. Nice is kind of empty, right? It's like there's no substance to it. I'm just being nice for what, you know? So when we are coaching with someone, what is in service to them? What is in their best, what would serve them the best? And sometimes that means calling out something that isn't working for you, making a different choice rather than accommodating. And yes, it may in certain circumstances, and I think you may be a slight anomaly, Scott, in that the work you do is a lot about financial advising and things like that. But when you are working with clients who you are coaching, often we're in the position where we can reflect and mirror back to the client the experience of other people in their lives by saying things like, hey, when you show up late to every session, this is the impact it has on me. So we still need to finish on time today. I can't go over. You know, it's that kind of thing. And it's like, oh gosh, here I am not being accommodated. I might need to do something different. right? So for the client, that's actually in service of them. Just an example. But I think that question is the one to sit with. What is actually in the service of the client? Sometimes, often, it's not about, especially if you're building some kind of resentment, it's not about accommodating them.
Mm.
Yeah. Jane, you unmuted.
Yeah, I was just, before you talked about, you know, time boundaries and available slots and that kind of thing, I was thinking, I think that's where it shows up for me. And I'm just sat here thinking, I'm going to try and notice this, you know, in the future, but I think it shows up for me, the accommodating more in the way that I run my business than actually with clients.
Right.
Yes. As in, I think I feel more able to accept conflict within the container of coaching in that relationship. However, you know, I have an online calendar and I make it as available as possible. The other day somebody booked a session at 9 o'clock on a Monday and I kind of went, oh, I thought Monday was my admin day. And of course it is, but I make it available. So I think it shows up for me in pricing, time availability. It's my needs that get sacrificed.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm excited about the changes you're going to make in the next couple of weeks. You won't know yourself. Yeah. And the thing I found is, as soon as you say, oh, look, this is my availability, what could work for you? People will find something.
Yeah, but I always think, but they might, I always think about what the client might need or what the other person might need and how I can be as accommodating and literally as accommodating as possible, literally.
Yeah.
And my husband's a therapist.
Yeah.
And I'm always saying to him, yeah, why don't you offer evening slots or why don't you rearrange that session? And he's just going, no, I don't want to. And I struggle with his immovability.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because he could be an inspiration for you.
Yeah.
Gone. I know, it's a bummer, isn't it? I know,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good. All right, loving this. Loving this. Okay, so another style is that's really common is the avoidance style. And this is, you know, literally we just kind of withdraw. We avoid. It's like just leave, even sometimes leave without leaving the room, right? Where you just sort of like check out of the conversation. If you've ever been, this may or may not apply, but if you've ever done anything like online dating and you've been what the kids call ghosted, where you've had a connection with someone and then they just kind of stop contacting you, it's like they turn into a ghost. That's usually because they've got an avoidant conflict style, right? So I have several friends who are in their 50s and dating after a marriage ended who are just kind of loving this and quite happily passing this on to people. It seems you have an avoidant conflict style. But our clients will bring this stuff to us, right? Where, you know, what the hell happened? Is something wrong with me? It's like, well, maybe it's nothing to do with you at all. Maybe it's their conflict style, right? They don't want to hurt your feelings and they've never had the courage to say this words, I'm just not into you. And so you're left doing all of this emotional labor trying to figure it all out. I've also found with clients that you can sort of see an avoidance style sometimes as kind of willful ignorance, and I say that in as compassionate a way as possible. But I've had conversations with clients over the years where they've ignored multiple infidelities from their partner. It's like, we just won't have that conversation. It's too hard. Or sort of not noticing or failing to notice that your teenager isn't at school again. You know, zoning out instead of talking over a problem. Anything of that nature where it's like, it's quite fascinating to me how avoidance in its an avoidant conflict style and it's kind of, you know, zenith can be kind of self-delusion where we sort of delude ourselves that, oh, if we don't talk about this, it somehow it isn't real, it isn't happening, right? So having said all that, right, there are huge advantages and some intelligence around an avoidance style. Usually someone with an avoidance style has a pretty good radar for knowing when it's worth having the conversation and when it isn't. Walking away or stopping the conversation can sometimes absolutely be the right thing to do. And, you know, there is some real advantages to not engaging, you know, especially if there is low trust in the relationship. I think trust is a huge part of this. When you've got high trust, there's usually a high tolerance for conflict. So, you know, avoidant, I'm totally avoidant when it comes to strangers on the internet. I'm like, sweet, block and report, bye. Easy. Don't even think about it. Has no impact on me at all. But when it's a, you know, when there's much more trust and investment in the relationship, that avoiding, I it sits with me and I'm like, oh, I know I'm not having the conversation I need to have here. Anyone relate to that avoidance style?
Yeah, I think I can.
Yeah.
That goes back to that kind of withdrawal. But interestingly, I noticed it. I've had maybe three clients in my whole time of counselling and coaching that have just suddenly stopped. And you kind of get in touch and go, you know, do you want to carry on? What's happening? And like, nothing. Mm-hmm. Okay, last chance saloon. Here we go. Yeah. Nothing. And you kind of go, oh, okay, that's really interesting. And it's taken me a while to kind of go, you know what, that's their stuff, not mine.
Yep.
I'm not gonna spend all my time and headspace trying to work out, did I do something wrong? What was it me? What, you know, it's like, that's their stuff.
It can be so like healing for us as practitioners to realize it's probably that they've never had a good ending.
Yeah.
Endings for clients who just kind of disappear or ghost us, that they don't know how to end something well. Yeah. So just avoid it. It's always interesting to me who doesn't come to our closing call, right? Love that. There's always something, right? Always interesting to me who isn't at different calls. But yeah, and it's that thing of, I just don't know how to do an ending, so I'm just not going to, the way I do endings is I don't come. It's easy, right? Yeah. Yeah, particularly for a relationship with a practitioner that we may have revealed things to, or, you know, shared real intimate details about our lives with, or, you know, even just kind of had them in our corner during some tough stuff. It's like the relationship, you know, really does need honouring in some way when we're ending. Yeah. So yeah. How might avoidance show up in people's practices? Super, super common one for me as a coaching supervisor, just not talking about the relationship. Something is weird between us, we won't talk about it. So, we take, and you know, I sort of see this as, it's almost like taking refuge in politeness. I'm just not going to raise the dynamic that feels funny. I don't really know what's going on. Something feels odd. You may feel anxious. You may feel like there's things being unsaid, or it might just feel like there's something in the dynamic between you and a client that is off. And what we're not talking about is the dynamic. So even things like asking for client feedback, no one does that, right? They might tell me something negative. I don't know if I can handle that, right? But it's actually a really great thing to do, you know, in the realm of, you know, particularly group programs, but also, you know, one-to-one clients. We often wait till the end of a client relationship and then say, well, how was it for you? It's like, it's too bloody late. We're finishing now, you know. So just notice that, oh, do I have feedback process in place for a client? Would a client feel safe to tell me if something wasn't working for them? And if not, what could you do to change that? What might you do? And, you know, writing something on your website probably doesn't count. You probably just have to have a conversation, right? It can be something that's great to build into like an initial chat with a client. It's like, so if at any point things aren't working, or we have, you know, something that either of us don't feel is okay, let's agree that we'll do our best to have some courage and have the conversation, even if it feels a bit awkward. You know, and often our clients need it worded in that way so that, you know, it's safe to do that. And we just remind them, you know, every couple of calls, how is this going for you? What are you noticing that's different in your life as a result of our work together? Are we still on track? Is there any changes you'd like to make? You know, all these kind of just really caring questions. It means that a client who may have trauma in their biography where they were shut down, where they didn't get the opportunity to express their needs, where even if they haven't had that as a kind of negative experience, maybe it's just an experience they've never had, right? When you create that in the context of the coaching container, it creates more trust, more safety. It's a great thing to do. But yeah, pretty much most supervisors will tell you, like, the sort of number one advice is when people go, something's weird, it's like, just name it, right? Like, just name it. That's almost like every piece of advice. covers about 80% of stuff. And it's hard to do that. Yeah. All right. Adversarial style. Adversarial style is basically what it says on the tin, right? Probably have people with this kind of conflict style usually have a bit of a competitive or combative nature. They tend to be always up for a debate, bit of a willingness to stand for something, defend a position. They often have views and opinions, right? And you sort of know these people. They can be quite energetic. They often see conflict as an opportunity to express themselves, right? It's like, it's not bad at all. It's actually like, yeah, let's have a chat. Let's have a debate about this. And, you know, I love what Adrian said in the chat earlier that, you know, actually it can be really affirming to be with someone who's quite adversarial. Like when the conflict style is, you know, look, this is how I feel about this thing, and this is what I want, or this is what I need, or whatever, you know, whatever it looks like. It's like, oh, I know where I stand now, I can relax. For those of us who have grown up with a lot of chaos and uncertainty and nobody really knowing what's going on, it can be really great, really great. So an adversarial style has huge intelligence to it. I tend to think that people with a naturally adversarial style tend to, and I don't know what comes, if it's chicken and egg, right? They tend to express qualities that we would see as necessary for leadership. But I also wonder if we just expect leaders to kind of know what they want. And so they naturally, if they have an adversarial style, they'll naturally sort of float to the top, because usually they're like, oh no, that guy knows what he wants. You know, he's really, you know, he's really sorted. He's got an idea about things, you know, and it's usually a he. Because, you know, women who tend to be quite adversarial are often called much less complimentary things, right? We're all socialized to never be angry. And if you're a woman of color, doubly so, right? So there are these kind of cultural tropes that we associate with an adversarial conflict style, when actually I think, you know, it's huge intelligence to this. And I love, you know, most of us have gone through a sort of teenage stage where we didn't know that we weren't supposed to be angry. And we slammed a few doors and had a few swears and really pushed on those boundaries, right? Really had a crack at, well, where is the limit here of my acceptability? For a lot of us, that kind of, you know, built-in rebellion was actually a pretty kind of life-affirming time. So it can be really liberating to be around someone who has that that adversarial style. Usually they're pretty good with a no, pretty good at saying what they mean. They're not usually choosing things that are based on the happiness of other people, right? It's like, this is what I think. Equally, right, this can tip over into some limitations and drawbacks, right? Often if you have an adversarial conflict style and it's devoid of empathy, what you'll usually find is that everyone else is accommodating you. So it can put other people in a state of quite deep unease. And it may mean that you're cut off from real connection with people because others won't risk arguments with you. They may not really, you know, sort of feel safe around you even. There's almost like that thing of, oh, I'm not quite sure which version of you I'm going to get. So I'm just going to manage and massage the volatility as best I can and walk away quietly. I also think, you know, from what I've read and what I've found in clients is sometimes a person with an adversarial style can treat other people as an adversary. Like even when there is no conflict, it's almost like, come on, I'm coming at you. They're sort of braced for it. It can be really common for folks with that style to find it kind of easy to relax and enjoy themselves. It can be a bit like my identity is in the debates I have kind of thing. And I was sharing with the class this morning that I've worked with a few folks, particularly in the first sort of 5-6 years of my practice, where I was still getting referrals from my old corporate jobs. And I worked in the finance in the city in London, so finance industry, as alpha male as you can imagine, and it's as parody as you can imagine. But worked with a few men particularly who were recognizing that they needed to do something different to kind of move to the next level, that their sort of bluster and fury wasn't going to be enough. And so reluctantly came to coaching because someone had said that, you know, coaching, so I'll come and talk to you, but I don't really want to be here, and let's just both acknowledge that. And, you know, I don't know how you all feel about working with a client who has this kind of conflict style. We talked about this morning, that sometimes that idea of, oh, I don't know if I could work with someone like that. And again, you know, what I found is actually when you name it, when you say, oh, I actually feel a bit like I need some armor on today around you. What's that like? Do you wear armor? Like, is this, you know, is this you? You don't seem like you kind of want to be here and you're a bit braced. That's what I'm sensing. You know, is that true? And I have had so many people, particularly men, who it's like you give them permission to say, oh, I've got some armor on. There is this physical, visceral response to that. And I think, you know, we often end up having conversations around, where did you learn that was how to be a man? What other choices do you have? That kind of thing. I had one conversation with a guy who was in his office when he had the coaching call, and he was quite tearful. And someone came in sharing some of this stuff, you know, and you end up sort of meeting the boy who's like, I'm just trying to figure out what the rules are. And someone came into his office without knocking, and he just let rip, like, get out, blah, 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 do not come in here. And he was just embarrassed, you know, more than anything. He was a bit embarrassed, I think. And then was embarrassed that I'd overheard this, and he'd sort of, you know, demonstrated this very adversarial, aggressive style. And that was it, kind of cut off the conversation. And then very quickly after that, cut off the coaching relationship, because just couldn't hold both. In that it was too vulnerable to share that. So all to say, just it's okay that sometimes our clients aren't ready to talk about, you know, the alternatives or the choices we can see for them. And you know, I learned a lot from him. He was, you know, underneath it all, really a boy who was trying to figure out what the rules were and just had shitty teachers that gave him pretty one-dimensional versions of masculinity. So I always, you know, I think about that a lot whenever I'm, you know, see folks out there who are demonstrating this very kind of, you know, adversarial style. It's like, wow, you have to live in there. You have to live in that brain. What's underneath it? I'm wondering if any of you feel like, oh yeah, I can experience that adversarial style. Maybe you get irritated with clients. Maybe you're accommodating so much that it boils over into resentment and you're like, if one more bloody person reschedules this week, right? Just notice like, oh, when does that sense of frustration kick in with clients? That anger, perhaps. Worth reflecting on. I'm just checking the chat here. Oh, I love that, Adrian. Once worked with a client where we had a session, it was just totally off. The next time we met, I started the session by naming what I noticed. It was much more pleasant as a coach than to stew in the awkwardness. Yeah, ideal. Ideal. Yeah. Angela, it was a bit panicky, like to hear someone yell at another human while I was on the phone, I think it was Skype or even teleseminar or some ancient piece of technology. Yeah, but very much so. It was a little bit like, oh, goodness. And Jane, have a session coming up with someone who is quite angry, adversarial, quite anxious about how I'll respond. Yeah, or the anxious about being on the receiving end, even if it's not directed. Yeah. What happens for you, Jane, when you're in that situation with someone who is quite angry and adversarial? Do you want to share?
I'm not quite sure what will happen, actually, but I suppose my fear is that I'll just retreat, disappear.
Yeah.
I'll find it really difficult to stay present and to hold the space.
Yeah. And like, as you think about it now, like, what choices might you have? Because you've got the choice to kind of retreat, whether that's literally or metaphorically. What other choices do you have?
Well, to do what you've just talked about there, to call it out.
Yeah.
You know, to say, I can hear a lot of anger being expressed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed I'm not even saying that in a very clear way. I even feel a bit... I don't know. I go a bit woolly, actually.
Yeah. And how great to have that insight. Oh, gosh, when I'm even anticipating that, I have a bit of, like, oh, I don't know, I feel a bit, oh. Sorry, I'm not articulating either. I'm mirroring it back to you. But I think one of the reasons we talk about the emotion cycle in this module is very much because we are likely to have these kind of quite activating emotions. So are our clients. So an option could be to absolutely say, yeah, I hear a lot of anger there. Hear a lot of anger in what you're describing. Would it be helpful to explore that? You know, asking for the consent of the client, could we ever look at that? What you can do is take them through the emotion cycle. And it's just four steps. And it's literally like to get them to notice the sensations in their bodies around the anger. Just invite them to just recall the event or whatever it was that has brought up this anger. And just to kind of go inside, notice the sensations. And all you're doing is slowing them down so they can have the somatic experience of being with an emotion without responding. So, you know, asking them questions like, you know, what are the sensations? What is there a color or a pace or a temperature to the sensations? It's like, and you can kind of have some humor with it. Like, this might sound a bit kooky, but we're just looking at what this is like, your experience of it, right? Because I want to give you some help to be able to feel this so that you can respond in a way that you're proud of. And so we get the sensations, we name the emotion, and almost guarantee you when it comes to anger, there'll be something underneath it. It might be sadness, it might be loss of some sort, there'll be something there. And I can't recommend enough the Gottman Institute. If you just Google the Gottman Institute, they have this tool called the Anger Iceberg. If you ever want to explore anger just as a sort of fun-filled activity of an evening, you can have a look at that diagram, and it gives you all of the stuff. Anger is often the presenting emotion because sometimes it feels safe because it's, you know, it has so much fire and power to it. Underneath it will be the perhaps more difficult stuff. And so we want to encourage your client to just name what's happening for them. And they may not, they may kind of wash over it. That's still okay. The third step is to say, what's the message from this anger, or the anger plus the grief, whatever else comes up? What's the message from this? Why do you think this is here? What does it want you to know? I know it's a slightly odd question to ask, but because we're not used to being with our emotions, but I'm constantly stunned by the intelligence of the client who will say, oh, it's telling me that I need to not abandon myself in this moment, or it's telling me that I need, you know, something will be there that is so helpful. And it's coming from the client. We can't predict this, but we can hold it for them. By the time you get round to that step and it's like, okay, can you just kind of notice, like thank that message and notice that your experience of that emotion will have shifted, because it will take about 2 minutes to get round to there usually. And almost every emotion will, you know, our bodies will take us back to homeostasis within about 90 seconds. The emotion will shift, even if it just lessens in its intensity. You're teaching the client a couple of things. One, that they can be with anger without expressing it. And two, that their anger isn't there by accident. But also that they actually have this intelligence within them, and they can do that at any time. They can just say, I just need to leave for a second, or I need a wee, whatever they need to say to kind of avoid the confrontation or whatever comes out usually, and they've got the space to go and feel the thing. I'm constantly stunned by how many people just don't know how to do that, don't know how to feel their feelings. And I didn't know how to feel my feelings until well into my 40s. It's still for me a bit of a like conscious practice. I like to solve my feelings. So just to offer that when you have a client who just wants to get angry, what they use, particularly with an adversarial style, they're used to expressing it. And what you're inviting them to do is something different. Sorry, Jane, I've done a lot of talking there. How can I help?
No, it's really helpful. What I think I've noticed a few times with different people is that often the anger is accompanied by an extreme avoidance of any responsibility. So it's always somebody else's fault. And sometimes I find it quite hard to get someone to sit with the anger because they just want to go back to the problem that's not them.
Yeah.
And fix something that's out there,
yeah.
Not feel something that's in here.
And actually, the fixing something that's out there is code for I want someone else to be different.
Yeah.
And that's not in their remit, right? Like, that's not something that they can actually do.
So then you get to the, I can't remember who's the Holocaust survivor that said, that talked
about. Dr. Frankel?
Yeah. So we can all choose how we respond
yeah.
to things. That's the gift we have within our power. But if somebody's angry, then that kind of offering can be quite yeah. incendiary. You're telling me it's my fault that I'm not.
I think it's about how I totally understand what you're saying. And I think it's about how we kind of frame it. Like, look, maybe the guy was an asshole. Maybe someone else is the bad guy. I still want you to be able to, you know, feel your feelings. Would still help you to be able to, you know, respond from a place that you actually feel proud of. So it's actually almost about saying, you might well be right. You know, what should we do about all of this anger?
Because as an accommodating person, of course, what I'm doing is I'm projecting onto them. I'm thinking, you shouldn't be angry. You should accommodate. You should think about it from the other person's point of view. And if you think about it from their point of view, then you can soothe things and not. Yeah. Okay. Entanglement.
Isn't so it? What it is, and what I love about your awareness of this, Jane, is that you're not just seeing this from the client's perspective. You're seeing where you give them your conflict style. And by just noticing that, you'll be so much more like detached when you have the conversation. Right? Like, can you let your client just have their feelings? You can be angry, it's okay.
Hey, I'm almost looking forward to a session now.
Brilliant. Bloody brilliant.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one. In this emotion cycle, you'll see that there is the feelings wheel. It's worth having a little squiz at that and just noticing what of those emotions do you find really difficult to be with? And therefore, what might happen if a client rocks up in that emotion? Yeah, because we'll probably avoid or accommodate or do something around that. You know, that's where our conflict style can show up as well. So it's like, oh, can I get used to that? Can I practice that feelings wheel myself and go through the feelings cycle? You know, notice which are the emotions that I find a bit tricky, and then you know, go through the emotion cycle where you actually on purpose feel it. So you can see, oh, look at me, I can experience deep resentment, you know? Does that help you, Jane?
Yeah.
Really cool, really cool. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Sass. A couple of things, that's really interesting conversation. I love listening to that. A couple of things that spring to mind to me is I'm sure it's some of the work by Dr. Gabor Mate I was listening to on trauma. And I'm sure he was saying that by not feeling our emotions, it can be manifested in certain illnesses and disease. And just to touch on that, you mentioned about feeling, what's still a little bit murky for me is what really are the benefits of sitting with and feeling our emotions, whether they may be anger, or sadness. Because I've heard that said before, but I guess it's just a little bit murky for me. And when you say name an emotion, do you mean name it anger or sadness or whatever?
Yeah. So what I have found personally, as someone who found it quite tricky and absolutely shared that, like, what the hell does it mean to feel your emotions? Surely you should just like numb out from them or avoid them or whatever. Like, it never really occurred to me that that was a thing you could do. But what I found is that as you develop an emotional vocabulary, right, and the way we do that is that we get used to feeling lots of different things. It means that we are able to feel more alive, because I guarantee you, if we are avoiding anger, we're also pretty good at avoiding joy, right? We're also pretty good at avoiding pleasure. We can be pretty good at sort of numbing out from lots of things, excitement. I noticed that for me, I did a bit of work last year personally on my self-doubt was giving me lots of cause to worry about disappointment. And I found that as I got more and more comfortable feeling disappointment, I also could feel excitement. So all I would say is, it sounds like this might be an area of curiosity for you, Scott. And what I would suggest is to go through that emotions part of the module, give it a little read through, and start practicing that, right? Like, one of the kind of homework exercises, if you like, I would sometimes give to clients is say, I just want you, every time you notice a red car, just check in, how am I feeling? Or choose some random object, right? But the idea that you can check in with yourself during the day and just kind of go, oh, what am I actually feeling? Because I think a lot of us are pretty shut off from our emotions. But as you get more and more used to feeling a range of different things, life becomes more vibrant because you're opening yourself up to the full experience of it.
Okay, that makes sense.
And it's hard to talk about because you kind of need to experience it, you know? Yeah. But that's definitely been my experience, is the more that you open up to one side of an emotional experience, the more you actually allow yourself to feel that, you know, the positive opposite.
Cool.
Nice, great question. Yeah. Cool. So the last style here is the passive aggressive style. And this is a combination of avoidant and adversarial, right? So we're both avoiding the thing we want to say and we want to say it. Right. So it's like when it doesn't feel safe to express something, we'll often indirectly express it and it comes out as passive aggressive. Right. What I would say is there is huge intelligence to a passive aggressive style. All satire is based in this style. Right. It's about speaking truth to power a lot of the time. If you're at the wrong end of a power dynamic, then a passive aggressive response can be a safe way of expressing stuff. Can be very humorous and creative. And because it's about being indirectly upset with someone, it will eat away at trust. It just will. Because it's like you're kind of saying but not saying what you mean. So, you know, this from passive aggressive, I have to say, one of my favorite styles, particularly when I was working in a corporate environment that I felt was slowly killing me. It was a survival technique. Humor was a survival technique generally. But it wasn't ever addressing the thing. It wasn't ever actually addressing the real issue. So it's just good to notice, like, where might you be undercutting yourself, self-depreciating, using sarcasm as a way to indirectly express something. And what would it mean to just say what you mean? what could happen there? What does that open up to you? And sometimes this is, you know, does show up in your coaching work. Sometimes it doesn't, but just something to kind of notice. Where does humor come in? Is it ever at the expense of someone else, including yourself? It's probably going to have some element of that passy aggressive style. So the ideal spot we want to get into, the one where we feel the most resourced when it comes to conflict, is where we can access the strengths and intelligence of all of those styles. So the humor of the passive aggressive style, the compassion of an accommodating style, the assertion of an adversarial style, and the empathy of an avoider. Yeah. When all of those things are in place, it's almost like you can't go wrong. You know, you can hold it a bit lightly. You can, you know, be clear but empathic and compassionate to both of you. And you usually will get to a resolution that is all right, even if it is, you know, the sort of general position where let's agree to disagree. Yeah. So all to say that it's really worth having a little reflection for yourself on the styles that you tend to use. Notice if that you know, default style, if you like, for want of a better term, is always the right one or the best one. Is it the one that leaves you feeling like you can be really proud of what happened? Or are there other choices you could make? Where might this be showing up in your client work, in your business, you know, the work around your client work? What choices do you have? And the thing is that you start to see, oh, there's something that's holding me back on a specific thing, perhaps, or there's something that I'm just not willing to look at. Just have a little look at it, right? Be willing to do that. And you just open up that sense of being resourced that you can advocate for yourself. The thing to notice is that these styles are also in their intelligence are also reflecting, you know, the compass of the healthy adult self, right? That actually when you are expressing something that you really value, you're in the sovereign of self-belief, right? It's like, this is what matters to me. When you're paying attention to, you know, your own emotions and needs, that's very much about self-acceptance. When you're advocating for yourself and drawing a line in the sand and saying, look, this is okay and this is not okay, that is self-worth. And when you're trusting yourself to make the best choice in the moment, that is self-trust. So, you know, I always say to clients, any conflict that you're in is a huge opportunity to really look after yourself and learn something about yourself, to really do something that will make you feel proud. And what I found is that it's often a bit of a gateway drug, because they only need to have one or two experiences where it's like, oh, I can ask for what I need. Or I can just say what's okay and what's not okay. And, you know, no one dies, including yourself, you know, just as a humorous point. But there is that sense sometimes that, oh, I will be annihilated if I do this. Like the relationship will fall apart, or there'll be huge loss, or I will be made to be wrong. And when they find actually when their relationship has high trust, there's a huge amount of capacity for conflict. It's often our assumption about what will happen that is the thing that is getting in the way. So my hope is that this is stirring up some stuff around your own relationship to conflict. Do this in a way that takes care of you, right? We're always kind of looking after ourselves in this. So, you know, don't ever feel like this is a problem that needs to be fixed. It's more, oh, I've got more choices now, you know, is it just a healthier way to think about it. But yeah, just notice what is going on with me in conflict. And that may be something you want to chat with your classmates about in practice pods. What patterns are you noticing? What choices do you want to make? do you want to give them a sort of before and after of a, you know, a conversation that you might be due to have? Next week, we're going to talk more about using these tools with clients and how we can do that. So it would be great if you can sort of familiarize yourself with the main tools, and then I can answer questions. We can talk about what comes up for you, anything that you've got going on. Okay. Hope this is helpful. Yeah. Cool. All right. Adrian, get well soon. And everyone else, take care of yourselves. And I'll see you next week. Yeah. Study group on Thursday at 5:00. Okay. All right, loves. Take care. Bye-bye.